Good morning and welcome to the Friedberg Quarterly Podcast. I'm David Rothberg, and with me, as always, is Al Friedberg, Portfolio Manager of the Friedberg Global Macro Hedge Fund and the Friedberg Asset Allocation Fund. Good morning, Al.
Good morning, David. And how are you?
Fine, thank you. Some housekeeping. Today is Thursday, the 27th of January. And before we start, I should point out a radical change in our approach to the podcast. My partner, Michael Grant, told me that we sound a bit flaccid and a bit just a bit lengthy, going on for 45 minutes to an hour as we have in the past. So I'm going to try and be a little bit punchier, and Al and I are going to try and wind this up in 30 minutes. We don't know if we're going to be able to pull it off in this, our first new format podcast, but that's our goal. With that in mind, I'm going to start off, just jump right into it. And by jumping it, the it that we're going to try and jump right into is, of course, inflation. Al, inflation is the theme that has dominated your thinking now for the past several quarters. And if anything, it's gained momentum in your mind, and I know in your portfolio. I don't think since 2008 I've seen you as committed to an idea. Can you talk to us, please, about your view toward inflation in a general sense to begin?
Okay, David, thank you. Yes, inflation to me is the main issue for 22, main economic issue for 22 and 23 and maybe 24. It's a problem. We're falling further and further behind. And the reason we're falling further and further behind is twofold, really. Number one, the Fed's inability to understand what's driving the inflation. We've heard Powell speak many times. We've heard some Federal Reserve people speak many times. Never have they actually addressed the fact that we have been printing money at such a high rate. Powell never mentioned money, and money is what central banks are all about. So it's kind of surprising, and more than surprising, and because they have not mentioned it, I believe that itself is a problem. And it will take time until they do, and maybe when they do, by the time they do, who knows where we're going to be. So we're falling further behind. That's one reason. And the second reason is, from our point of view, which we think it is money, and it's the excessive increase in the supply of money, it is not shrinking. Money is still growing. Now at this moment, it's growing around 1% a month. And it probably will be picking up momentum as private banks will increase their private credit. And the Fed maintains a negative, a very, very deeply negative rate of interest in real terms. So I don't see any prospects for an improvement. The Fed has lost control of it. I think they really have lost control of it. I can but say it in the strongest terms possible. They have lost control of inflation, and they even have lost control of the expectations. The public expectations now are beginning to take that into account of rising inflation. We see wages pushing higher. We see wage demands pushing higher constantly every day in every single industry. So that's the problem. And I really think that we have to be prepared. All portfolios have to be very well prepared for this moment. It is true that Powell was a little bit more aggressive in his last conference, and now there are some people who I trust how they read the tea leaves, and they say that it's possible that we should be expecting 5 or even 6 increases this coming year. But even then, it is a bit of a joke. 6 increases will get us to 1.5% of 1.5% if they do it 0.25% each time. 1.5%, it's how do you compare that to a rate of inflation that's running at 7 and probably running at 9 or 10 by middle of the year, or maybe more? So that's where we are. That's the problem. That's the single biggest problem.
Now, the counter argument to that is that the inflation was caused by supply side issues that were the result of the pandemic. Supply chain bottlenecks and labor disruptions, and a temporary addition to demand caused by the government trying to keep the economy running prior to or in the wake of the pandemic. and having as its mandate an attempt to rescue the economy from below 2% inflation, the fear of deflation or disinflation that had prevailed since 2008. How do you argue against that?
Well, I don't buy that because supply chain problems could cause inflation in some areas. Okay, you could have what's called relative prices. The prices increase in some areas, and it's justifiable. You know, if you're not getting supplies, and there's a reduced amount of supplies, then you will bid for those supplies, and the price of chips, let's say, will go up, or the price of tires will go up, or some particular thing will go up in price, and maybe 50 things will go up in price, but not right across. Not the breath that we're having, and not commodity prices like oil that are not under this problem of supply chain. And yet the price of oil continues to rise. We are now hitting new highs. We are now close to $90 a barrel. Natural gas remains strong. All base metals remain very strong. So the story doesn't wash. The supply chain promise is very particular to specific products. And maybe 50, maybe 100, maybe 200 products or 200 items, but it's not across the economy. We are seeing price increases everywhere. And especially in commodity prices, which is very significant. I've always maintained that commodity prices are most sensitive of all indicators when it comes to inflation. I've maintained this for years. And we see it coming off the March 2020 bottom. Commodity prices began to run up, and they're still going up, and we're still making new highs. So I think the story is gone. The story is gone. I think the Fed has abandoned the story. It's clear. They've said that there's not a question of transitoriness. Let's forget about that. But the problem is they don't know what's causing it. That's the problem. And because they don't know what's causing it, it's just like escaping from it. It's exploding.
Okay, let's move on then. And with this conviction that you have that we have inflation that is embedded now in the economy will persist for several years and may accelerate. How have you structured the portfolio so as to protect yourself against a more conventional basket of assets and how to take advantage of it?
So you want to be long assets. You want to be long certain types of assets, because when you have negative interest rates, you want to be long assets that do better than that. And that means, for example, you could be long, or you could be, if you should be long, or you could be long anyway, good equities. When I mean good equities, I mean companies that rise with a nominal GDP and that pay fair dividends, maybe 30, maybe 40% of the earnings. That's a good asset. That's a good asset. And I can think of many industries like that. Home builders are like that. Mining companies are like that, especially the big ones, you know, the ones that mine copper and iron ore and other base metals. Banks even are selling relatively cheap. Well, banks are working under a cloud, which is a regulatory cloud, and that's a big problem. I mean, that won't allow the expansion of PEs. But still, they're able to make money in this environment for now. Not so much because of the rating, not so much because of the shape of the yield curve, but because they're able to put out loans. And now they feel comfortable about it. The economy is strong. They don't have so much risk, or they don't think they have that much risk. So they can make money doing that too. So there's a number of industries that you could be long, a number of places that you could be long in the equity side. You do want to be long commodities.
You are long.
We are long home builders. Yeah, we are long home builders. Exactly. You're right. Exactly.
And you are also long. You were also long. To explain to listeners, not just home builders, but also miners. On the equity side, and on the commodity side, you are long assets via a basket of commodities, but changing your focus from time to time. Can you talk about that?
Right, exactly. We focus on commodities, so that's another asset class that you want to be long commodities. We shift back and forth. We have moved recently more away from all commodities into gold and into oil specifically. But we have been shifting and doing that for the past 2 years. We have gone back and forth between those assets. But you want to be long commodities no matter what. And that's an asset class. And another thing that we found that's very interesting, and it's not an asset class, is a way to play inflation directly. How do we play the CPI increases directly? And that was always our focus, was trying to say, okay, we have indirect ways to play it. Commodities are indirect ways to play because, you know, commodity prices can go up, but we don't know what's the exact relationship. And there is no exact relationship between the CPI and commodity prices, but it's like a general feeling that prices are going up, but you don't have a direct relationship. And we found a way to do that. And it's been around for a little while. Shame on us that we didn't realize that before. But one way, of course, would be simply to go long treasury-linked, inflation-linked securities and short an equivalent amount of nominal bonds that have no connection to inflation. And so the difference between the two, the return between the two, would actually give you what's called the break-even, would give you a play on inflation. But that's cumbersome. That's very cumbersome, and that it requires a lot of capital. And it's not so easy to find the right issues that match. So we found that there is a very well-developed swap market, right? Interbank swap market, and where the largest banks make a market on something that's very, a derivative or that is very closely aligned to the break-evens. And probably, and I imagine that the way they many of them hedge it is they hedge it through the securities market, through treasury-linked security, inflation-linked securities and nominal bonds. But they make a market. It's an active market. It has a fair spread. Like, for instance, just to give an example, a 2-year swap, inflation swap, is around 330, 340 today, meaning the market expects inflation to be 330, 340 for the next 2 years per annum, 330, 340 per annum for the next 2 years. So if you think that inflation is going to be higher than that, you just buy these. Let's say you pay 340, and if inflation is, I don't know, let's say inflation is 7% is the first year, and 7% the second year. Let's just say that's 14%, and you committed to pay 7%, right? 3.4 times 2, 6.8. So you're making a full 7% profit on a dollar number that you pick, right? So you can do it on $100 million, you can do it on $500 million, you can do it on $5 billion, whatever the number that you pick, that inflation gain or loss will be applied to that dollar value. And so we found that this is a very good way of doing it, especially because, and this is very important, even if you're not a big believer in inflation, but you're just an odds maker, you're just somebody who likes to play with odds and probabilities and you're the gaming type, right? Inflation is running around at the moment around 0.6, 0.7% a month. Well, if you, the two-year swap at which we're committing that we take on is something like 0.3% a month. That's the expectation. So the market expects inflation to go down for the next few years to average 0.3, but we are running 0.7 for the past few months as an average. So it's a very interesting bet, just even from betting odds, that you may not be off by too far. We think that the monthly rate of inflation will pick up in the next few months, that we will have 0.8 and 0.9 and 1 and 1.1 and 1.2. So there's a very large profit to be made. But you have an opportunity to get in at less than the current rate. And that we find extremely attractive. And we have taken a very strong position in those swaps.
So that trade is being long commodities,
the swaps,
gold in particular, gold miners and home builders is a traditional way to play an inflation bet. This, as you say, is a direct bet on the CPI. It's essentially right. measuring the CPI via the break evens.
I just wanted to add one thing. The CPI itself is a faulty measure of inflation. It, and I'm not saying that I can do better. I don't think anybody can do better. I think it's very hard to measure inflation. Very, very hard. Thousands of hours, millions of hours have gone into how to design and devise a better system, a better formula. And it has been corrected a number of times over the past 30, 40 years. But we're still not able really to create an index that will faithfully reflect inflation, consumer inflation. At any rate, whatever it is, it is. And so the good thing about using the swaps is that you are trading that measure, right? You're trading that measure. Whereas if you're trading commodities, you could be trading commodities and prices could be going up. And maybe a CPI index that's designed by somebody will not really reflect it. I tell you something, even the one that we have today, the CPI index that we have today, does not, in our opinion, reflect faithfully inflation. Because, for example, the rent component not only is small, relatively small, but it's not market-based, right? It's sort of like a survey of what people think they would get for new rentals. And it catches up very slowly, if ever, to the true increases in rent. I mean, house prices have gone up 20% a year for the past few years. And yet rents seem to be going up at 3%, 4%, or 5% a year. It doesn't make a lot of sense. So there is a problem there. But anyway, what I'm saying is you can be, you know, you can be playing the traditional way, as you mentioned, commodities, gold, whatever, and be right, but not actually be right on the CPI itself, because CPI may not reflect it. In this case, we have a direct play on the CPI besides our play in the traditional areas.
Now, your feeling about inflation is that it's going to accelerate to far above where the current swap rate is. But in addition to that, you also think that inflation is going to be persistent for several years and may extend beyond the term of the swaps. Are these swaps rollable instruments?
Yes, they're rollable, meaning every month, 1/24th, we have taken a two-year position, right? So every month, 1/24th of that position expires. You earn it in a way, let's call it that way, in simple terms, you earn it because you already know what the CPI was. So that's coming to your pocket or coming out of your pocket if it's worse than expected. But at any rate, 1/24th is gone. And so all you do is now you buy and 1/24th again, you replace it. So that's what we're doing now. We're replacing it. We started with a 24-month position and X dollar and an X dollar, you know, the amount of dollars that we're betting on so that inflation will reflect that $100 million or $500 million or $1 billion. And 1/24th expires, so we buy another 1/24th again. So we're constantly rolling forward 2 years for now. If we could go to three, I mean, it's attractive to go to 3 years, it's attractive to go to 5 years, because the 5 years is still today no more than 250 or 260. But the longer, the further out you go, the more risk you have. And the risk, David, is not so much the actual inflation rate, but it's the expectations that what can happen to that swap during that period. To give you an example, just in December, when Omicron started spreading rapidly, there was a fear and a justifiable fear that we would go back to lockdowns and economic activity would collapse just like it did in early 2020. The swaps that we owned traded down significantly during that period because the market expected inflation to go down to zero. Right. And that was a justifiable fear. And so if you have a 2 year swap, your risk is much less than if you have a 5 year one, because then the loss is not multiplied by 5 years, it's only multiplied by 2 years. Right. That's why. So right. we feel that keeping the 2 year swap is sort of the best the best balance. You know, we could go to three, but we think the two and just keep rolling the two. We should be able to do well with that, very well with that.
Okay. Let's move on to currencies. In the past, during the last huge inflation bout, which was around the time that we started in the mid 70s, trading currencies, being short the dollar, long the yen, long Swiss, long at the time Deutschmark, was a very profitable trade. Is the currency universe part of your inflation outlook?
No. And the difference is very substantial between then and today. In the 70s, we had a number of countries follow a hard money policy. They were concerned about inflation, and they didn't allow their money supply, especially to say the Bundesbank, in a very clear picture of inflation and a monetarist picture of inflation, and they did not allow money to grow fast, so that inflation was much lower in Germany, so was the Switzerland, and so was in Japan. So we had three hard money currencies. And so you could use them as a way to trade against the dollar. That's no longer the case today. Today, almost every single country has inflated. And the only difference between one and another one is which country has inflated more than which other one. But it's very difficult to capitalize anymore on such differences. There's no more dramatic differences. And so Great Britain is inflating, and Japan is inflating, and Europe is inflating, and the US is. And so you're not going to be able to find enough room to be able to say, okay, this currency should appreciate by 15% against the dollar, or 10 or 15%. It's just too difficult to do that. A few smaller countries do have a stronger and a more rapid response. For example, Brazil had a very radical, very dramatic response to the inflation rate, and I think the bank rate went from like something like 3 or 4% to 10 practically in less than a year to bring inflation down, and the currency stabilized. It was going down and the currency stabilized. It has not gone up, but stabilized. Other currencies have been relatively strong for particular reasons. Central banks, and primarily central banks in South America, have raised rates, and so they have been faster. The Czech Republic has done that. They've been faster in responding. But we're not talking about big differences. So it's not worth it. It's not worth following the currency market.
Last year, the Global Macro Fund had a wonderful year, was up 30%. And I think that it would be easy to imagine that, in effect, what you did was leverage a long position on the S&P. Because the S&P, you were very much correlated to the S&P. But in fact, very little of those returns were generated by long positions in the S&P. A lot of it was generated by long positions in commodities. And a very big part of it, or a significant part of it, was generated, in fact, by short positions on a basket of unprofitable tech stocks. Is the short tech stock position also in a way inflation related, in as much as those stocks weaken as interest rates rise? And as interest rates rise, of course, in expectation or in an attempt by the Fed to rein in inflation?
Yeah, that's a good point. They do. Companies that don't pay dividends are, we call them long duration, right? Because you expect the return to come in 10 years or 15 years from now when these products mature and they make money. So if rates go up, you start a higher discount rate will make that final terminal value 10 years from now, 15 years from now, much smaller. And that's why they're affected when the prices go down. So it is related. It is intimately related. As soon as we started worrying about rising rates and a change in the Fed policy, you saw many of these companies begin to come down. So yeah, but it was a very short-term trade. It turned out to be a little bit longer than short-term. I didn't expect it to stay a year in that position. I expected to stay a month or so, but a month, maybe two, but it actually turned out that we have been short for 4 months And we should be closing it out pretty soon. We did take good money out of it, and we should be closing that position pretty soon. But there is some relationship. There is a relationship between, you know, rising rates and companies that don't generate earnings at all.
Are you not concerned that after that yesterday, when Powell spoke, he essentially omitted guidance from his rhetoric and created a situation which reads to me and to some of the people that we subscribe to as he's going to be data dependent, and the default value is raising rates and to not raise them if the data suggests so. But at the current time, it seems clear that what he wants to do is raise rates. If that's the case, yeah. Will those tech stocks not go lower?
Yeah, I think that they do, and I think that they mean it. But as we discussed earlier, I don't think that they have an idea of how far to go up. Right? I mean, right now they're still in their heads thinking about reaching neutral rates in 2023. Neutrality for them is something like 2.5%, and that's way insufficient to what we need. But we are going into a rising interest rate environment, but if the spread between inflation and the Fed rate continues to stay as wide as it is today, or even worse, it widens, it's not going to be all that bearish for many companies. If you look, for example, what's happening in the junk bond market, the credit markets have not reacted as badly as some of these sectors in the stock market. Even low quality credit has not reacted as poorly as stocks, as these tech stocks, by far. And one of the reasons is because we are still dealing with negative rates. And so many companies that may not have been able to make it are still able to make it today because they're borrowing money at rates that are cheaper than what they can sell products for. Right, so you have to keep that in mind. You can't be completely negative because you're still dealing with negative rates. I think that is, we got to have this in front of our eyes, constantly in front of our eyes, in front of our minds. Is there a gap between the Fed rate and inflation? And if the gap continues to be what it is today, even if it were to narrow to 300 or 400 basis points, it's still very negative, deeply negative. And so you can't get too bearish about equities, right? You can't get too bearish. You can talk about 15% declines for an index or 20% decline for an index. And in some sectors can go down 50 or 60%. But as a group, I don't think you can get, as we said before, can get that bearish as long as rates are that deeply negative. In real
geopolitical
terms.
Geopolitical tensions in China and Taiwan, in Ukraine and Russia, inflationary or not inflationary?
I don't know. I don't think that they are. I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, they will have an impact in some commodities, right? Again, relative prices, not absolute prices. So you might see gas go up in price, especially in Europe. You might see oil go up. You might see the price of chips go up because an invasion of Taiwan, who knows, that could close down some of their factories. And we depend on some of them. But I don't think that has a... an effect on the general price level. You know, that has an effect on parts, on pieces, on components, on areas, but not on the overall thing. Now, there are other problems with this kind of political dislocations that have to do with corporate profits and what will happen to U.S. corporations that have operations in Europe. And I don't know, the controls would be put on or it could have an impact on the corporate side, but not necessarily what we're afraid of, which is inflation. Not necessarily. It could have an impact just on individuals' commodities, but not necessarily on the pace of inflation. In the end, only money counts when it comes to inflation.
Al, I got my eye on the clock here, and we're in the home stretch. I think we're going to make it in 30 minutes. I want to end it with a discussion of a not particularly pleasant topic. That's the Friedberg Asset Allocation Fund. So far, our discussion has been focused on the global macro hedge fund because it's only in it that you have those inflation swaps. The asset allocation fund, its mandate doesn't allow for that kind of leverage position. It's lagged the global macro fund by quite a bit. What can you do there, or how are you capturing the inflation theme in that fund?
Yeah, so it's a little more difficult. We cannot do swaps there. We cannot go short there. We cannot leverage. But we should be able to do well. We have a large exposure to mining companies right now, gold mining companies, but we might add in the future some companies like BHP, Rio Tinto, base metal producers, things of that sort. But we have a good exposure there, and we have a very good exposure still in housing, which we believe is an excellent sector to be long. In addition to that, we have a direct exposure now to gold futures and some natural gas futures. We're using the futures market, but we're not leveraged. The fund is not leveraged. So I do think that the asset allocation, and already this first month of the year, you know, the asset allocation fund is down a little bit, but it's doing much better than the S&P. And we think that for the year, we will do well. We'll actually make money, and we'll be far ahead of the performance of baskets of stocks or the S&P.
Well, you're well ahead of the S&P so far this year, I think by 15%. You beat the S&P last year handsomely. Congratulations. Keep punching. Fantastic interview. And speak to you next quarter.
Okay, very good, David. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.